I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes today, a primer on libertarianism, from civil rights legislation to why Rand Paul didn't get an allowance. But first, where are we on compensation for Gulf Coast businesses? BP has been paying claims in the Gulf, but in addition, there's that $20 billion escrow fund set to be tapped this week. And there's been some confusion as to how that fund will impact lawsuits and settlements down the road. So let's get some answers from Chris Wernowski. He's a reporter with the Pensacola News Journal in Pensacola, Florida. Chris, last week, Ken Feinberg, who's administering this $20 billion fund, said that within a week, businesses could file for 6 months of lost revenue from the fund, as opposed to the monthly loss claims that they've been filing directly to BP. So, first of all, has this six-month filing started?
Well, he said within a week, and I think what you're seeing in this process is a lot of things that are being said and sort of changes as we go. And so, you know, they haven't definitively came out and said, okay, start bringing us your six-month claims. You know, there's some 80,000 claims, I think, that have been filed so far. And one of the concerns of a lot of people is that they were going to have to come in month to month and essentially reapply for this money. And what Feinberg wants to do is, at least what he says he wants to do, is take some of the burden off of the people who are already kind of suffering down here.
Well, Ken Feinberg told Fox News that the claims that have already been paid out, and they're now up to about $148 million, will not be part of the $20 billion escrow fund that's being set up, implying that going forward, these new claims, these new six-month claims, will come out of that $20 billion fund. Do we know who can file? For instance, does oil have to be visible in your area for you to file?
He has said that, you know, each of these has to be examined individually, which is kind of what's been going on right now. And the difficulty they sort of face coming forward now is who is what they call directly impacted by the oil. And, you know, he has said that there are going to be some people who are indirectly affected by the oil that may not see any money out of this fund. And I think what this is set up for immediately is for people who have real obvious loss, things that, you know, fishermen and people who are legitimately suffering. Now, you know, if you have a landlocked hotel that is losing tourism revenue, you know, they may have some sort of claim, but it may not be resolved by this money that is coming out of this fund.
Right.
Even though BP has pledged to add more money to this in the future, you know, what this is meant to do is get money to the people who are hit the hardest faster than they could get it through the legal system.
And Feinberg said he's going to decide on a subjective case-by-case basis. He says he knows, for instance, that a Boston restaurant that is suffering because it's not getting enough Louisiana shrimp isn't going to get compensation. But a beachfront hotel in Florida that's losing business, even though there's no oil there, there's just a misperception that there's oil there, he says they might get some compensation.
Yeah, but, you know, again, you know, there's a lot of discretion and a lot of subjectivity in this process. And when he was doing this stuff at the 9/11 Commission, he looked at a lot of the cases individually. And I think you have to be very, very careful of fraud. You know, I don't think he wants to get a reputation of just handing out money to anybody who walks in the door. And he has some tough decisions to make. And there are going to be people who feel left out in the cold. And, you know, unfortunately, their only recourse might be through the legal system.
Well, let's talk about the legal system. Now, we already know that businesses will not lose their right to sue BP if they take that six-month payout. But they might lose their right to sue BP if they take a larger settlement down the road?
Yes. And then there has been a lot of confusion about this. And believe me, I was confused about it for a while as well. And what you really need to make the distinction between is an emergency claim and what they're sort of defining as a settlement. That comes later. You know, right now, what they're doing is trying to get money in people's hands now. You know, people who are suffering and people who might be losing their homes because they can't work. You have to make that distinction because, you know, people's only recourse down the road might be to go through the court system. And, you know, we have no idea what this looks like on the other end. You know, if there are going to be complications and issues that have never been seen in court before. And so if you're a person who has a claim, the discussion that you should be having with yourself and your family is, you know, is it worth the wait or should I take what I can get now?
Chris Wernowski with the Pensacola News Journal. Chris, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, America has its Republican and Democratic dynasties in the Bushes and Kennedys. Now it has its first family of libertarianism, Texas Congressman Ron Paul and his son Rand Paul, who just won Kentucky's Republican primary and is running for the Senate. In a New York Times profile, Rand explained the family thinking. He grew up without curfews because, like government regulation, they could have unintended consequences. For instance, a kid racing home to make a curfew could have a car accident. Rand also didn't have an allowance, too much like a government handout. He also recently said he didn't like the part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that forced businesses like lunch counters to serve black customers, and that President Obama's criticism of BP was like putting a boot heel on the throat of the company. Kind of shocking to people who thought libertarianism just meant smaller government. Today, let's get a primer on libertarianism from Jeffrey Miron, a Harvard lecturer and senior fellow at the Cato Institute. His book, based on his course on the topic, is Libertarianism from A to Z. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you.
You've got this book that's come out to introduce people to libertarianism, and there's Rand Paul being quoted saying, you know, that Civil Rights Act. Your thoughts when you heard that?
Well, my main reaction was I was upset when he backed off once he got challenged. So libertarians are completely sympathetic to his basic point, which is that private property should be treated by the government as private. And so a restaurant owner or lunch counter owner should be allowed to make whatever choices that person wants about whom to serve.
But, you know, it was gasp-inducing. Really? Even when they're not letting black people sit at that counter? Take us through that example, because it is one that's in your book, the Civil Rights Act. Make your case against it. You've just said you think businesses should be able to run themselves.
So the Civil Rights Act actually has two, roughly speaking, two parts. It has parts that were meant to prevent the state governments, specifically the southern state governments, from engaging in discrimination. Then it had other parts, the part that got Rand Paul in trouble, the part about public accommodations and about employment discrimination, that were constraints on private individuals or private businesses engaging in discrimination. Libertarians are totally fine with the first set of parts, the parts that ban discrimination by governments. And the libertarian view is that those changes, that part of the Civil Rights Act, would have, combined with all of the private actions that were taking place already, the boycotts, the protests, the out-migration of blacks from the South, to have undercut Jim Crow and changed the atmosphere so that in all aspects of life, there would not have been nearly as much discrimination.
In other words, you're saying that it was starting to happen anyway, and you also felt that the government dismantling some of its own laws that brought about discrimination was a good thing.
Exactly. It was the federal government telling the state governments that the state governments could not continue these policies that were explicitly discriminatory.
Right. But then you get to the counters, the lunch counters. Make the case that it isn't a good thing to tell businesses that are keeping people from sitting at lunch counters that that's not allowed.
So the question is not whether it's a good thing or whether someone should tell lunch counters that it's not a good thing. The question is to libertarians at least, is who should tell them? Should the marketplace tell them because blacks and whites who are non-discriminatory will start to patronize lunch counters that are not discriminatory? Should boycotts start to put pressure? Or should the government be the one that tells those lunch counters?
So you're saying the market should have shut down those lunch counters that were discriminating and that blacks themselves should be the ones to take up this cause. They were, and they were getting hosed down in the streets and attacked by dogs. I mean, at this point, doesn't the government have to step in? And secondly, isn't this easy for you, Mr. White Guy Libertarian, to say, because it's not your kids who had to wait decades and decades and decades for this kind of change to come about?
I certainly understand that it's awkward to be in the position of a white male who had all sorts of privilege, you know, growing up, was not discriminated against, to be making these statements. But I still feel that it's my job to analyze it as I see it. And the libertarian view is a whole set of things. Both the government actions, the federal government actions against the state governments and the private actions were on the path to jointly freeing up enough of Jim Crow that private actions would then have done much, much more on their own. Now, maybe it wouldn't have happened as fast. Okay, that's certainly possible.
Yeah, it took 100, we're now 100 years after the Civil War.
And this I understand. Happening. But we think it would have happened in a way that's better. I had an email response to my blog from a person who said he was a black man who said, I don't want the government to tell people they can't discriminate because I want to know who's discriminating, so I'm not giving my money. I'm not buying lunch from a guy who discriminates, okay, but has been told he has to pretend he's non-discriminatory. I want to know who's out there being discriminatory so I can go elsewhere.
Well, we could stay on this one topic for hours, and I'm sure, by the way, if our listeners have thoughts, send them to hereandnow.org. Just click on Contact Us because we want to get a little deeper into Jeffrey Miron's new book, Libertarianism, A to Z, and your overarching point, the answer to the question, what is the appropriate size and scope of government, is always, and in a libertarianism point of view, small government across the board. So let's go broader. Isn't this the worst time in American history to make an argument for libertarianism? You have the collapse of the financial market. Most economists agree due to the lack of government oversight and the failure of markets to do what libertarians believe that they do, which is, you know, make rational choices. Even uber-libertarian Alan Greenspan said that he was, geez, I made a mistake. I was wrong in thinking that that's the way it worked. And then you have also the newest crisis, which is the oil industry that apparently didn't do what it was supposed to do. Yes, there was government oversight that failed as well. But many people see this as the time for more and better government oversight.
Well, let's take the BP case first, because there, I think you have a situation where the federal government gave BP permission, the deep water drilling in the Gulf, an action which clearly raised some possibility of serious harm to various people's property. So if the federal government's going to give them permission, it ought to do so in a way which insures people. That could be by forcing BP to buy insurance. It could be by forcing them to post a huge bond. It could be by enforcing appropriate regulations, if that can really be done. It could well be. We should never have let people drill there because we don't have any way of knowing whether it can be done in a sufficiently safe way.
Well, isn't it an overarching illustration, though, both this and the financial collapse, of the whole, you know, invisible hand idea, the idea that people will make the right choices because their wealth is at stake? That just has been completely undermined.
So the libertarian view on the financial collapse is that absolutely there were private parties, the big banks basically, who did a lot of incredibly crazy things. They should have been allowed to fail. Libertarians are almost unanimous in thinking that the TARP was an unmitigated disaster because it rewarded all of that excessive, greedy behavior. So that part, okay, I think, is easy for libertarians. Did the private behavior by itself cause the problem? Their libertarians, and many economists, disagree. They would argue that the government planted the crucial seed through its involvement in the housing market.
A couple thoughts. You have people like Michael Lewis saying he looked real long and real hard. He didn't find very many people who were making loans to poor people because the government was twisting their arm. They were doing it because they knew they could buy and sell them, and they knew they would never get them paid back.
But they knew they were guaranteed via Fannie and Freddie. And it's not just the Fannie and Freddie. It's that the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, allegedly a libertarian, but I think we're going to take away his card for being a libertarian, okay, gets up in front of Congress and basically says, don't worry, we know there might be a bubble, but it'll burst sooner or later. I'll fix it. Now, an insane thing for a libertarian to do, to encourage the private sector to just not pay attention to risk.
Well, again, each of these issues could be debated for hours, but today we're hearing a libertarian point of view. And as we'll hear after the break, there's more than one. Harvard economist Jeffrey Miron's new book is Libertarianism A to Z. You know, we'd love to hear your thoughts as well. Just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email. You can just leave a comment right there. I'm sure you have many. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Texas Congressman and Libertarian Ron Paul today joins his son Rand Paul in criticizing government response to the Gulf crisis. The first tar balls are now washing up in Galveston, Texas, and Paul said National Guard troops should be there, not, as he said, fighting wars we don't need. Well, is that a libertarian point of view? And if so, which one? Economist Jeffrey Miron's new book is Libertarianism from A to Z. And Jeffrey, you remind us that there are two kinds of libertarianism, philosophical and consequential. Tell us about both.
The philosophical approach basically says that people have basic rights, inalienable rights, to their persons, to their property, and that government policy should never infringe those rights. So obviously certain kinds of government policies do infringe rights. A law that says you can't smoke marijuana says that you can't do certain things with your body, with your property that you want to. A law that says a business owner can't pay below a minimum wage interferes with that business owner's ability to use his business as he sees fit. And so that's one approach. My approach, the consequential approach, is somewhat different. It says, let's take a look at the problems that some people think justify interventions from the government. Let's ask how big those really are. Let's ask to what extent private mechanisms might moderate those problems, not necessarily solve them, but at least make them smaller. And then let's ask very carefully whether the particular interventions that are being proposed can actually make things better and do so without generating tons of unintended consequences. So let me illustrate with sort of my favorite topic, which is drug policy. The philosophical approach just says, hey, I have the right to do whatever I want with my own body, so I can smoke marijuana or use cocaine or anything else if I want to, because I have a right to that.
It's closer to anarchy. Yeah.
It sounds sort of like anarchy, because if you take it to the extreme, it says there you could never raise any taxes at all, even to pay for, say, a military, because taxation, of course, takes people's property away. The consequentialist approach says, well, certainly some people misuse drugs, okay, and they harm others, okay, by so doing. Some people use drugs and harm themselves. And so maybe government policies to reduce drug use do make some sense because there's harm that's associated with drugs.
Wait a minute. Did I just hear you, a libertarian, say that the government has a role in protecting people from themselves?
No, I said some people say that it might have such a role, or at least there's a concern there. It's reasonable to ask. The consequentialist is willing to say, yes, it's certainly true that some people make bad decisions for themselves. It's self-evident. It would be silly to pretend otherwise. But the question is, which policies will reduce the harms from drugs, okay, while not causing other bad things from the policy? And so in particular, if we're talking about drug prohibition, outlawing drugs, libertarians are united in saying that drives markets underground. It doesn't seem to discourage drug use very much. It doesn't seem to discourage use by the people who are irresponsible in their drug use. It mainly discourages use by people who would be somewhat more responsible. It generates crime and corruption and adulterated drugs that make people even sicker than the drugs would be if they were sold in a free market. And so the treatment is just way worse than the disease. The consequentialists don't say there's no disease at all, there's no problem at all, but we say this policy is a terrible approach to that. Other much milder policies, like a sin tax, the way we treat alcohol or cigarettes, okay, those might be better than nothing at all, than just laissez-faire. That's a different conversation, but at least those are moderate. Those recognize a balance between the cost of policy and the cost of the thing that we're trying to fix.
Well, I'm going to pick another example, abortion.
Mm-hmm.
You take the stand, first of all, that even if it is, as opponents say, a taking of life, you say sometimes in this society we do allow the taking of a life, let's say the death penalty. So you put that debate aside, and you say the thing to look at is what are the unintended consequences of not allowing abortion?
The policy of banning abortion isn't going to completely eliminate abortions. Some women will go, if they have enough income, will go to other countries or other parts of the country that have legal abortion. Some of them will end up having back alley abortions that are, of course, very dangerous to the people who have them.
And it's that person's decision, not the government's
decision. And that the consequences of interfering with that decision sets a precedent that then opens the door for government other interventions that are unfortunate. Then you can also interfere about a person's right to use drugs.
And this is where libertarianism really collides with conservatism. Everybody's out yelling about small government, but libertarians are very different on that in that way from conservatives.
Libertarian and conservatives certainly have some overlap. On the strictly economic things, they would tend to be in similar camps. But on all the social issues, libertarians, in contrast to conservatives, want to legalize drugs. They want to legalize gay marriage.
And prostitution.
Legalize prostitution and gambling. They oppose don't ask, don't tell. And so very, very different than the conservative perspective.
Are libertarians heartless? This idea of, cutting the government out of people's lives, even something as small as arts and culture subsidies, trying to bring dance or theater to inner cities or to kids out in rural areas who might never see certain things. You say this is just a handout to elites under the guise of benevolence.
I don't think that most arts funding that comes from government ends up providing dance opportunities that can be seen by people in rural communities who don't get much access. Much of it is subsidizing the Boston Symphony or things like that, or the Kennedy Center in Washington. And libertarians try to be very consistent. Sports stadiums are the same thing. The guys in the skyboxes, okay, are not sort of the poor people from the inner city. The people in the skyboxes are the rich businessmen who are buddies with the legislators who help build the stadium.
Do you think this is a new time for libertarians?
I think it's an interesting time for libertarians. First of all, the conservatives and the Republicans didn't do very well by themselves in the 8 years that they had under the Bush administration. Not only was there a huge amount of pork barrel spending that was silly, there were these two very aggressive wars overseas, which I think the country is gradually to see were incredibly misguided, incredibly costly. There was lots of big government under Republicans. The liberal perspective is also getting some pushback, I think, from a reasonably broad set of people because it's just clear that the spending we can't afford. We've gotten to the point that we are just going to go bankrupt, so we need to rethink.
Jeffrey Miron, he's a lecturer in economics at Harvard. His book, based on his course on the topic, is Libertarianism from A to Z. You must be so much fun at cocktail parties.
You know, I used to study monetary policy and interest rates and all that. And at cocktail parties, people's eyes always just like glossed over and they found somebody else to talk to. Now, since I've been studying drug policy and prostitution and all this stuff, it's much more fun.
Jeffrey, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, let's take a look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a look at how women veterans are having difficulty getting health care from the VA. Also, the showdown between Washington and Arizona over that state's new law regarding illegal immigrants. That's all tomorrow. Latest news is next, Here and Now. Much of the country is in a dangerous heat wave, beaches packed. So in addition to all the cautions, we thought of swimsuits. They are why they invented the Land's End catalog, you know, so you can shop in the privacy of your own home. But many men can just get away with throwing on gym shorts, to which fashion designer Ronan Jehezkel says, "Feh." Ronan Jehezkel of the Park & Ronan clothing label joins us from his office in New York. And what mistakes do you think men make when they buy bathing suits?
Men tend to wear a big, baggy, wide swimsuit. I call it a cheerleader skirt.
A cheerleader skirt?
That's the biggest mistake. I mean, one thing that men tend to maintain in a great shape for a very long time is the shape of our legs. And why would we cover them?
So you're saying if you've got good legs, what, go with shorter bathing suits?
Of course, yes, if you've got good legs, go with shorter. If you have spaghettini legs, i.e. really skinny legs, then you go with a little bit longer, but narrow.
Narrow, not baggy.
Exactly.
Well, talk a bit more about the ones that you design, because they seem more like classic swim trunks. The New York Times wrote about your suits, and they say it's the kind that Sean Connery and Daniel Craig wore as James Bond, you know, so we can picture them.
Right.
Do you really think that men can go back to those classic shorts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is a classic. Even today when you sit and watch a 50 movie of Marcello Mastroianni on a Vespa, you say, my God, it's hot.
Yeah, but most guys, and forgive me, guys, but none of you guys looks like Marcello Mastroianni.
Well, if they would put themselves in things that actually emphasize the assets, they would look like Marcello Mastroianni.
So to speak. Well, and as you say, most men do have, you know, very nice legs. But then there's the other half. I mean, what about the waist? I mean, what can you do to make your waist look better if you're a man?
If you have something hanging, the worst things that people tend to do is wear those elastic waists. Now, the elastic waists cut your belly, give you these love handles, they call it, and this is the worst thing that can happen. So if you have a bit of a stomach, then just make sure that you wear a soft waistband so it doesn't squeeze your waist.
Yeah. Well, and you take this very seriously. First of all, we understand you don't have mirrors in your fitting rooms?
Absolutely not.
Why?
If you go from this gigantic swimsuits to a little bit more minimalistic or revealing, people freak out. So if they're by themselves without any support and courage, then we lose the sale and they still look terrible on the beach. So we bring them outside to the piazza, we do the critique together, and you know what? They learn.
And by the way, your name is on the suits. These are designer suits.
Exactly. That's what I said to all of my customers. It's my name in the back. Please don't embarrass me. Get out. Let me look at you. I make sure you look amazing.
Well, and we understand you started designing suits to add to your clothing line.
Right.
Because
right.
You couldn't find one that you wanted.
Exactly. We had a little cabana on the in the Hamptons, and I wanted to have like a really cute little swimsuit, and I made one for myself. I marched on the beach, and the next thing, everybody was asking me, do you carry them? When can we have them? I'm like, in 3 weeks. And from there, it took off.
What do you do for the guy who, you know, he'd just as soon wear his baggy gym shorts down to his knees? I mean, these are not cheap, are they? How much are the suits? What's the range?
They're running about $100.
Oh, boy. $100 for a guy who's used to just going from the basketball court to the water in the same shorts. You know, what do you say to that guy?
Well, I say to him, well, you invest those $100, and then you realize that it was the cheapest investment that you ever did to meet a girl, a boy, meet whatever you like.
You too can be Marcella Mastroianni.
Exactly. For $100, you know, people pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for, you know, plastic things. And then all I do is I sell you $100 swimsuits and you kick butt on the beach.
That's Ronan Jehezkel of the Park and Ronan clothing label talking about his line of classic cut short bathing suits. Ronan, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, anytime. Have a wonderful summer.
Okay, let's pivot. Just ahead, wildlife in the Gulf region. We'll speak with the Humane Society in 30 seconds here and now. Remember that claim a few days ago that sea turtles were being burned alive in controlled oil burns in the Gulf? Well, wildlife rescuers will now ride along with oil cleanup crews to pull endangered sea turtles out of oil patches, an agreement the Coast Guard and BP reached with several wildlife groups that had sought an injunction against controlled burns after claiming that sea turtles were caught up in them. Meanwhile, at least 1,200 oil-coated birds have died in the Gulf, and rescuers have saved more than 600 brown pelicans. For the latest on wildlife, let's turn to Wayne Pacelli. He's president and CEO of the Humane Society of the U.S. And Wayne, you recently visited one of the bird rescue centers. Tell us how that work's going.
I went to the facility in Fort Jackson. It takes them about 45 minutes to do each bird, and then they're moved outside and they acclimate a little bit, and then after some days, they're moving them to the east coast of Florida so they don't get back in the muck and in the oil.
Well, and the worst may be yet to come. We understand in late August about 15 million ducks and more than 500,000 geese will migrate to coastal Louisiana. No way to stop them. So what problems do you see down the line?
Well, it is the southern point in the what's known as the Mississippi Flyway, and it's known as one of the, you know, the great destination points for migratory waterfowl. There are some plans to do what's called short stopping, which is to grow grains or put grains out to cause the birds to stop short of Louisiana and to stay longer in more northern points in the flyway.
Huh, so there is a way potentially to stop them.
Well, a limited degree. Yeah. You know, this has actually been controversial with hunting seasons. The states in the south have long criticized the states in the north for short-stopping because they want to keep the ducks and the geese up there so they can shoot them. And it's been a controversial practice through the years. But now, actually, Louisiana and the other southern states want to see some of the short-stopping. But it's only going to reduce the migration of a limited number of the animals because there's no way you're going to prevent those millions of ducks and geese from getting down to the very marshlands and areas that are now infected and infused with this crude.
Well, we mentioned the sea turtles and the new agreement that rescuers can now ride along with the oil cleanup crews when they start up again after this bad weather to try to pull these huge sea turtles out of oil patches that are going to be burned in controlled burns. But we understand there are also plans to save sea turtle eggs. Wildlife workers are going to collect about 70,000 eggs in about 800 nests that are buried in the sand across the Florida Panhandle and some Alabama beaches. FedEx is going to help transport these eggs some 500 miles east to a temperature-controlled warehouse at Florida's Kennedy Space Center. This is an extraordinary effort, and when the eggs hatch, they'll be released on Florida's east coast, not the Gulf Coast. Do you think this is a good solution for the sea turtle eggs?
We essentially have no good solutions at this point. but some of the experts in the nonprofit sector, not just in the government, say that it's a good calculated risk given the alternative.
What about the other mammals? I'm thinking of dolphins, whales. You know, we know this was a deep underwater blowout, and for that reason, some of the oil has not surfaced. It's way down in the ocean's depths, not good. But is it slightly better for other mammals that it's that far down?
When I was down there, the first sperm whale had turned up dead somewhere, and any animal that is doing a lot of feeding on other creatures, like, you know, any of the baleen whales do, or the toothed whales like sperm whales, is obviously going to capture a lot of oil. So the higher an animal is on the food chain, my guess is the more oil they're going to be exposed to in their feeding, no mind just their normal traveling and migration activities that are going to cause them to run into, you know, oil on the surface or oil down lower in the water column.
This is Wayne Pacelli of the Humane Society. And Wayne, we now know that all the oil companies submitted plans to the government as to how they'd protect different animals in the event of a spill. And all of the oil companies listed walruses as something that they would protect in the Gulf. Of course, there are no walruses in the Gulf. What are your thoughts about what was allowed to happen and what has to happen now?
Well, it's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment for the oil companies, certainly BP, but all of the other oil companies whose plans were basically, you know, cookie-cutter operations. They had boilerplate language. They didn't reflect any, you know, serious-minded thinking about mitigation measures. They did not have any careful scientific analysis of what the consequences would be for these marine ecosystems. And it was exposed. Now we've got something affecting so many states, not just wildlife, affecting the economy of this region, the people of this region, the lifestyles and the livelihoods of people. It's just deeply distressing for anyone concerned about animals like us at the Humane Society of the United States and concerned about, you know, these wild animals so vulnerable to the toxic effects of this crude, which is spreading over thousands and thousands of square miles.
By the way, you mentioned the impact on the economy. You understand that the Humane Society also has to help out with pets in the area. Fishermen, for instance, who've had to give up dogs because they can't care for them because they don't have work.
Yes, you know, some of the parishes most affected and the people who live in those parishes who depend on a healthy Gulf have been relinquishing more animals to shelters. We just, at the Humane Society of the United States, transported a few dozen dogs from St. Bernard Parish and Plaquemines Parish up to Washington, D.C. to adopt them out. But it's obviously the wildlife that are suffering the most, and we need more eyes and more ears out on the water, in the marshlands, to rescue at-risk wildlife. And we need more volunteers integrated into the program because the area is so expansive and vast that the current assets deployed, whether they are U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service personnel or Louisiana Department of Fisheries and Wildlife personnel, that's not enough. We have to integrate more volunteers to get more people spotting oiled wildlife so they can be in a trained, you know, and professional way gathered up and brought to the center so they can be cleaned, so they can have a chance. Because if they're severely oiled and just left out there in the environment, they're almost certain to die. We don't know if they're going to survive if they get active treatment, but it's a better chance than just leaving them out there, that's for sure.
Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the U.S. Wayne, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Say good morning to my friends. Oh, my Lord, 6 a.m.
The song 9/11, which kicks off the new CD, History from Below, by the Southern California band Delta Spirit. It's filled with music both rocking and rustic from a group that got its start when drummer Brandon Young bumped into singer Matt Vasquez, who was busking in a local train station late one night. They got together with guitarist Sean Walker and John Jameson, added multi-instrumentalist Kelly Weinrich, and Delta Spirit was born. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock caught up with singer-guitarist Matt Vasquez before a recent show at the Middle East here in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Is touring fun? Do you ever get tired of it?
No, I don't.
I don't have much to. Well, I have a great house now that I live in with Kelly, and the bass player from this group called Tijuana Panthers, my friend Elena, and we like garden and hang out, drink coffee, and do other things. And it's, you know, it's really fun to have a home now, which I hadn't had. But no, I like touring. It's the best thing on the planet. So,
did I hear this right that all five of you are drummers?
Well, yeah, actually, I'm the worst of them. But yeah, that definitely, you know, you take a folk song and then you get a good groove and then you try to mess it up as much as possible from there on out, you know, make it as weird and interesting as you can. Torn into beaten and scarred.
Where do your songs come from? What's your songwriting process?
The songwriting process, for us, we try to always reinvent the wheel. And if you feel like you're doing the same thing you did before, then you need to abruptly stop and take a breath and go somewhere else with it. Because, you know, unless you feel like you're doing that, there's no point in doing it. And also, you know, you got to feel like you're saying something. And I feel like we're saying something with our music. There's definitely a spiritual element to our music, and there's definitely, like, a very, like, straight-ahead song sung to a girl. I wanna disappear far from the folks I know.
How much is California as a place a part of your music?
It's definitely so deep, like just with the friends that we have and the community of musicians that we are so fortunate to live in. Like we live in an area in Long Beach that used to be called the Gay Ghetto, and we have, you know, just it's so multicultural. But the musicians that live in that area just are really trying to make some good music and good art. You know, there's Core Kids guys live out there, the Growlers live out there, Tijuana Panthers live out there, and all these groups are just, we're all just trying to go our own way and make our own kind of music, and I'm really proud of that. The Golden State has been my home, but I place my
How long do you see yourself doing this?
Well, till I'm dead. Yeah. I wanted to do it since I was 7 years old, and it's the only thing I want to do. And if we get fans and we're people's favorite bands, because that's why you join a band, is to convince people to make your band their favorite. And we try our best every night to do that. You know, if it doesn't work out, you'll see me at the corner busking, because it's the funnest thing you can do with your life, or at least for me, just speaking from my experience.
And that's kind of how this band got started. Didn't they find you playing at a subway station or a train station?
Yeah, I grew up in Austin, Texas, and my dad in the Clinton years got laid off. We lost everything, and my dad's parents lived in Dana Point, California, so I ended up out there. And my parents slept in the kitchen. My brother and I shared a room. My sister had her own room. And we lived in, like, the richest area of California, but we kind of, like, barely made rent, you know? But I had no place to play music, except I'd go walk to this tunnel by the beach, and I'd play songs and sing songs. I've been able to go to Costa Rica 3 times because I sat there out, you know, in this tunnel playing.
Oh, scarecrow, you know why I'm asleep. All the way you bear, you cannot carry me. You know you're just like your mother, and you're back all back to go. And you hid your heart from everyone you know.
Then when I was 14, Nirvana happened, and that changed everything for me. And the first song I played on guitar was Come As You Are, and that kind of ethic that, or what that generation and what that music meant to me was that you got to make it right, and you got to mean it. And forget anybody else, you know, just go your path. And that's what we're trying to do here.
Is there a song on History From Below that you are most proud of all the songs?
Yeah, absolutely. The song about my mother's side, her parents, it's called Vivian. I lost both my grandparents on the first two tours that we did. I lost my grandfather on the first one, and then 6 months later, my grandma.
Sleep, oh sleep, my Vivian. Hell is too cold without you. Well, I'll stay right here above the clouds, waiting to see heaven with you. Well, I fall for each breath as long as I could, fighting with nothing to hold. The last breath I took blew through.
Sounds like what this music you make is really all about might be family.
Yeah, it is.
You're talking about your bandmates and your housemates as family, and you're talking about the importance of your grandparents. It's the music you're making is really about those bonds.
Well, we're our brother and sister's keeper, aren't we? And we got to keep it that way. You know, loving people is, regardless of wherever you come from, that transcends everything. And it's as true as John Lennon or Homer or Tolstoy or Gandhi or Jesus.
Matt Vasquez, lead singer and guitarist for the band Delta Spirit. He spoke with Here Now's Alex Ashlock. For more, go to hereandnow.org.
Hold on to my hand. Never let go. Never let go. Just two kids acting tough. Well, then we grew up. Me, not so much. All the other guys that you seen, nothing compared to me. Because my love is strong and my heart is.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
When we first met, spoke so brief. Well, you sang a song in my home sweet really. Do you recall the night we took the air out in the bush with.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.